In the 1970s, a serial killer was discovered in Houston, Texas. Dean Corll, known as the Candyman, killed at least 28 young men and boys. And it turns out that he recruited a young man to be his apprentice. A new book called The Serial Killer's Apprentice, authored by Dr. Catherine Ramslin and Tracy Allman, is an amazing book that details the crimes and describes how this apprentice, now incarcerated for over 50 years, was recruited to rape, torture, and murder these young victims. How did this happen? What's the psychology? We're going to talk to Dr. Catherine Ramslin, who's a professor of forensic psychology at DeSales University and the author of 71 books. She's appeared as an expert in criminal psychology on more than 200 crime documentaries and podcasts. Tracy Allman is a documentary producer, director, and writer here in Chicago. She's produced dozens of nonfiction programs for Discovery, Oxygen, PBS, and her most recent work is Peacock's documentary, which is the masterpiece on the John Wayne Gacy story, Devil in Disguise. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Ramslin and Tracy. How are you?
Doing good. Thank you so much.
The book was, I couldn't put it down. It was really, really riveting. And we've all read the books about true crime and serial killers, but this just took a little bit of a different view on the apprenticeship part of these crimes. Tracy, why don't you give our listeners a little bit of history, because I wasn't really familiar with Dean Corll and the crimes he committed. So bring us up to speed on who he was and what he was doing.
You bet. Basically, this is a case from 1973. On August 9th, 1973, a man was killed by the name of Dean Corll, and he was killed by Elmer Wayne Henley, who was 17 years old. Dean Corll at the time was 33, so twice his age. And basically, what had been going on that we find out immediately after this is that Dean Corll was a sexual sadist who was picking up young men and boys and sexually torturing them and then killing them. And so Elmer Wayne Henley had been recruited as an assistant, an accomplice, but ultimately he ends up being an apprentice. He enters into this relationship when he's around 14 or 15 years old. And what the kind of grooming process is for him is that Dean Corll tells him that he wants him to help him with a little bit of this, that, and the other. And then he kind of encourages him to do more, you know, possibly having a friend over. And then the next time that friend comes over, that friend is absconded with and killed. And eventually, Wayne Henley ends up killing with Dean Corll and another young man who is around his age, David Brooks. Once these bodies are discovered in August of 1973, everybody's checking themselves, the largest mass murder in U.S. history at that point. So everybody's wondering, how did they get away with it? And one of the reasons I started talking with Elmer Wayne Henley was because I saw parallels between him as an accomplice and people like Michael Rossi in the John Wayne Gacy case.
So, because just to fill everyone in my book, I talk about this, and in your docu-series, you talk about it, that John Gacy had two young men living with him at the time of some of these murders, and there's some really good evidence that there was some assistance that Gacy had with killing the boys and certainly with disposing of the bodies. Let's circle back. Dr. Ramslin, serial killers normally act alone, and we do see cases like this where there is an apprentice or somebody who's been groomed to help. Tell me what motivates a killer to do this, and then what motivates the young man to go along with this?
Well, it's actually about 20% of serial killers who work in teams.
I didn't know it was that high.
It's that high. There are quite a few. And some who've been arrested as lone predators actually did have accomplices. But we don't know a lot about those stories because they didn't end up in the media. However, those of us who research it do know about them. And someone like Dean Corll, in my opinion, since he's dead, it's hard to find out from him specifically, but I think that it was easier for him to use boys to bring boys back. Because if he, as an adult, was approaching them, that looks suspicious. And he wasn't that smooth at it. So using someone like David Brooks or Wayne Henley, was a lot easier and more inconspicuous for him, as well as he had the idea that eventually he could get them to commit these crimes with him, because he sometimes would bring in two victims at once, and he wanted this kind of teamwork. So why would they get involved in it? That's a different story.
Right.
Usually accomplices have some vulnerability. Many accomplices are young women who are in love with the predator, and they're afraid of losing him. But in the case of these teenage boys, it's often they're in some kind of financial need, or something is being given to them that they can't otherwise get. Like David Brooks got a car, he got a room to stay, he got money, and he was a dropout. He had nowhere to go. His parents really didn't have anything to do with him. And, you know, he's 14, 15 years old. So Coral supplied things that he needed. So he was willing to overlook what Coral was doing in order to get the things for himself. Henley, also from a broken home, was trying to help support his family. And Coral was saying, if you bring boys to me, I'll give you $200 or more if they're good looking, and they'll be shipped off to California to be pool boys to rich people, so they'd have a much better life than they'd ever have otherwise, and you have money, everybody wins. So that's how he presented it to him. Once Wayne did that once, he was leveraged.
Now he was part of it, and now he needed to go along with the program. So,
exactly.
You know, clearly the serial killer here, Dean Coral, was a sociopath. But Henley, when you come to know him through this book and through the interviews and through the comments he made and through the history that you go through, you know, he didn't come from a happy home, but a lot of people from unhappy homes don't, you know, help serial killers. I kind of felt like if he had never run into Henley, he could have lived a productive life, and he may never have been on the wrong side of the law. I know you can't put your crystal ball out there, but what do you think, Tracy? Do you think that Henley could have lived a normal life had he not got into the crosshairs of this Dean Coral?
I expect so, because this is an individual who was raised in a fairly religious home. And so he wanted to be a minister when he grew up. He used to walk around with a Bible in his shirt pocket. And his first goal was to take care of his younger brothers. He was the oldest of four. And so I think that he hopefully would have grown up, gotten married, gotten a job, and continued on his path. But the minute that he was compromised, his whole life changed. And add to that the pressure that he's got three younger siblings, and Dean Coral is constantly making threats and manipulating him. I've got a syndicate in Dallas that I, you know, could potentially sweep your boys or your brothers up into. And I think that that played on his mind, and the further he got into this, the more he did drugs to try to forget it, the more his behavior just continued into psychopathy.
This new book, The Serial Killer's Apprentice, authored by Dr. Catherine Ramslin and Tracy Allman, is available on Amazon, and I know you're doing some book promotions, and it's interesting because my book came out like right around the same time your book came out, and we only have about a minute left, but I'm going to throw this to Tracy really fast. Do you see, is there an intertwining between Gacy and Dean Coral, and if so, what would it be?
I believe that from my research, and I can't say for a fact, but I believe that the sex ring that started in Houston and had its origins in kind of California and Texas, you have individuals that were liaising with Gacy. And we have some evidence of their liaison, you know, in the mid-70s. So, yeah, I think that Gacy was part of this ring.
And certainly Gacy's crimes had a lot of similarities to those of Coral, in that there was a torture board, there was binding of the hands, and there were some things that were very similar, eerily similar, as I was reading them.
It's very possible that they weren't the only ones, but they were the ones that were discovered.
When I got involved with Dean Coral, it was like going through the looking glass. You know, nothing was real, nothing was right. I was living in a madman's world.
Were you a madman?
No.
You're a sane man in a madman's world?
Mm-hmm. I was a boy in a madman's world. It was a weird mesh of conflicting feelings because I was scared of him, and I thought he was sick. But at the same time, I didn't want to displease him. I wanted to please him. I wanted him, you know, to be proud of me.
You were listening to a jailhouse interview with Elmer Wayne Henley, who is the subject of The Serial Killer's Apprentice, a book authored by Dr. Catherine Ramslin and Tracy Ullman, who are our guests today. It's a new book. It's a great book. It's really interesting for those of you who like true crime. Dr. Ramslin, as you listen to Henley, do you think that he took responsibility for his acts, or do you think he's a person who is unable to do that?
I think he took too much responsibility, actually. He kept saying that he should have done something when this all happened, but he doesn't realize he was only 15. He was confronted with this very manipulative, skillful adult predator who had all kinds of tricks. And we know a lot more now about the impulsivity of teenage brain, that they don't tend to think long-term in terms of consequences. They can be easily manipulated and leveraged. So I think he didn't quite see that there were some mitigating aspects of his case. And he's beginning to see that now, but he certainly takes responsibility. He has never said that he doesn't want to take responsibility. He doesn't want anyone to talk him out of that.
And, you know, let's kind of go over how the serial killer, Dean Corll, was killed by Henley. Henley was the one who killed him. Dr. Ramslin,
the only accomplice to have done so, accomplice to a serial killer to have done so, and I think that's a really important point.
And can you just tell our listeners a little bit, Dr. Ramslin, about the circumstances how he came to kill his mentor?
Well, Dean had kind of an open house for kids to come and go, and Wayne brought a couple of friends, a girl and a boy, with him one night, August 8th, and they got high. They were huffing acrylic fumes. They were drinking alcohol. They were smoking dope. And they passed out and woke up where all of them were bound. And Corll told them he was going to kill them, but first he was going to have his fun. Henley managed to persuade him to undo his bindings and said that he would help him to kill the other two. But when Corll laid down the gun, Henley picked it up and told Dean, "Stop. You have to stop killing my friends. I'm not going to let you do this anymore." And Corll lurched toward him. He shot, and he kept shooting, as Henley had trained him to do, until Corll hit the ground.
So, in essence, he saved the lives of his two friends, and he probably saved the world from further murders. But that doesn't really discount the idea that Henley was involved in some of these other murders. So when you're reading this book, you're so compromised because you're like, well, that was a heroic act given everything that happened to him, given how he looked up to this Dean Corll. But on the other hand, you look at this and you say, when I was 15, would I have been pulled into this? I just can't imagine. So this, you use the term temporary sociopath. How common is that? Does that happen where someone is not really a sociopath but has a period in their life where they're doing sociopathic things like Henley was?
I actually don't use the term sociopath because it's an outdated clinical term.
Okay.
We have no diagnostic test for it. I use terms temporary psychopath because there is a diagnostic test for diagnosing somebody as a psychopath. And my idea about that is that under the influence of a predator like Dean Corll, or others, there are other kinds of partnerships like this, someone can be pulled into doing things with a certain callousness that they would not ordinarily have had they never met that person. And that once free of that person's influence, they can revert to their formal sense of morality. and are shocked at what they had done. And we have enough people who have made such statements to realize something's going on. What is this odd period? I understand what you mean when you say you feel kind of compromised. What, we don't have a word for somebody who, I mean, they're not victims like the victims who were sexually assaulted, tortured, and killed, obviously, but they're not the predator either. And we don't have a good middle ground between those two statuses. So it is difficult to know exactly how to process this case. I agree with you.
Tracy, you spent some time talking to Henley. Can you tell us what he was like and what vibes you got talking to him about how he reflects on that period in his life where he was doing these horrendous things?
It's interesting. I asked him the other day. I talk with him quite frequently, and we have been doing that for over 3 years. And I did go down to a prison in Texas to meet with him. And at every turn, I found him to be amenable, empathic. He is not your classic psychopath. He is not somebody that is so lost in his world that he doesn't understand all these nuances. And when I say nuances, I think the really interesting part that Dr. Ramsland was just talking about is that, you know, we can't really categorize him as a serial killer or as a victim. But I think the one thing that I really took away from this was his advice. He wanted to be able to use the experience that he had lived through so we can inform people today. How does the grooming process work? How did it work on him? What was done and what could have been done to prevent it from happening again? Because it happens all the time.
Do you think he will ever get out from a legal standpoint? Have you examined his status of his appeals, and is it a possibility that he will ever see the light of day?
He has the ability to get parole. He's never successfully gotten it. I couldn't tell you, but I do feel as though he has spent his entire life outside of being a teenager in jail. And so I feel like he's served his time. I don't know if he'll ever be able to get out, but I think that if we're being civilized, if we're applying the rules today, going, you know, backwards, I think that he should be out.
You know, I get that sense in the book, too. I mean, you know, I have done criminal defense work and I've represented bad people. But I don't really have the illusion that I think some people need to stay in. You know, the Gacy's of the world, to me, need to stay in for the safety of everyone. But this kid, from what you know in the book and from listening to him talk, he just, it seems like he got caught up in such a moral maelstrom that he, you know, he can't even believe that he was the same person. And you do feel some empathy for him. It really tugs at you. Dr. Ramsland, I was thinking while I was reading this of Ghislaine Maxwell and the whole Jeffrey Epstein thing. Is there a parallel here from what you know? And obviously you didn't study her case or talk to her, but is there some idea that she was involved in the same kind of thing?
Well, one of the things I do in the book is categorize different levels of being an accomplice, and that you do have some accomplices who are co-equal with the predator. They're in it. They're helping freely. They don't do anything to stop it. I think David Brooks is more along those lines than Henley was, certainly. And then you have someone who's a compliant accomplice, a reluctant accomplice, doesn't really want to be doing this, but is pulled into it. And then you have someone who might be a forced accomplice. And that would be someone, you know, you're holding a gun to their head. You better do this with me or else. And I have a sense that she was more a part of. I mean, she had plenty of means of getting out if she wanted to. She seemed to be more a co-equal in it. Now, I haven't, as you said, I haven't studied the case, so I might change my mind if I really look at the in depth. But my sense of it from what I've read is that she's a partner much more than an accomplice.
Yeah, and I think just from reading what I have read about the Jeffrey Epstein thing, you know, you just marvel at a person like her who did have means and was, you know, part of society and was, you know, flying around on private planes. And she seemed that she loved Jeffrey Epstein, but why would you supply him with underage girls? It just, it makes sense in a devised logic, and that I maybe it just goes to the charisma of people like Epstein. Let's take.
I mean, we have someone like Myra Hindley who did this with Ian Brady, the Moore's murderers in the 1960s. She was luring kids so that he could rape and murder them. And, you know, she was in love with him. She was afraid she was going to lose him if she didn't do this. So it could be that that's the kind of situation we're talking about.
Which is just one of those things where I'm just shaking my head on the radio here. Let's take a break. We're going to come back and wrap up. And we're talking to Dr. Catherine Ramslin and Tracy Ullman, who are the authors of a new book that you have to buy called The Serial Killer's Apprentice, available on Amazon. I want to talk a little bit. We're talking about Dean Corll. He was a serial killer down in Texas in the 1970s. He killed 28 young men and boys, and he had two apprentices who helped him with procuring the boys, committing the crimes, and disposing of the bodies. Dr. Ramslin, I was thinking about this while I was reading the book, and I was wondering if there is a parallel here with the Stockholm Syndrome, which was the Patty Hearst defense that when she was kidnapped, she began to associate with and sympathize with her captors. Are there still, I know it's not the same thing, but are there some similar elements here?
Well, that's certainly what one of his defense attorneys wanted to do during the second, the retrial that he had, was look to the Patty Hearst case. But one of the problems was that Wayne had been away from Corll at times. He came in and he came out. He went home. He was with his friends. Then he came back and was with Corll. So we did not understand back in the 1970s the nature of psychological coercion, that even if somebody is away, they can still feel under duress. They can still act as if that person's standing at their elbow, essentially. So these days, I think that kind of defense would fly better than it did in the 1970s.
There was just an article in the Tribune that posed the question, why are there so many serial killers from the Midwest? I read it and I was kind of like, that's kind of true. We got Dahmer and Gacy. Speck is probably more of a mass murder BTK killer, which is a person who Dr. Ramslin has spent many hours talking to, Ed Gein. I'm going to ask both of you, do you have any speculation about why that might be? Tracy, do you have an idea?
I want Dr. Ramslin to go first.
I mean, there's so many along the Pacific Coast, California.
That's true,
Pacific
too.
Northwest.
Yeah.
There's so many in Texas. There's so many in Florida. There's so many in New York. I just don't. I would want to see that person's research.
Yeah.
We have over 5,000 serial killers documented. I mean, I would want to see that research before I would comment.
Yeah, because I thought that, but now that you've said that, I'm thinking Night Stalker, Green River Killer, and all those people out there.
Yeah,
so,
right. So
you're right about that. Tracy, any idea?
And that's basically what my answer would have been, is that, you know, you've got a recent study that looks at how many serial killers may be at large right now. So I don't think that the phenomenon somehow went away. I just feel as though maybe modus operandi are more secretive. People have learned things from predators in the past, and I believe that this phenomenon doesn't really stop. You're always going to have a very tiny portion of the population where serial murder or sexual sadism accompanied by murder is going to be their case.
It just seems to me from a logical standpoint, but I don't know, that serial killers are going to get caught sooner these days just because of cameras, just because of the databases that we have. In the days of Gacy and probably Dean Corll, you know, the databases, if you crossed over a county line or a state line, the police didn't have all these things on their radar. And now we just have a better understanding of how, you know, how these things work, who pedophiles are, that they don't stop doing what they're doing, and that they're going to be caught sooner. Is there any statistic that backs that up? Either of you?
Well, I think the logic makes sense, but they're studying these things too.
Right.
They're going to be finding ways around them and are able to do so. There was one serial killer in England who studied the placement of CCTV cameras in his area so that he could figure out where was the best place to kill somebody. You know, so they do. They study it. If they're smart predators, they're going to figure out ways around it. And look, some of these serial killers haven't been caught. Like BTK got away with it for 30 years. Look at Samuel.
Oh, yeah, Samuel, the guy. He was,
Samuel Little. Four decades.
And
yeah, Samuel Little.
Like how many states?
How many decades was he going? And then you know, caught on something in California. But so many of his murders were completely under the radar, and because that's how he operated. He figured out the police are not going to look into these victims because they're, you know, sex workers, drug addicts, et cetera. He figured out the ones the police would not pay much attention to. And he was right to the tune of, you know, however many, 93 is what he claimed. We don't know, but certainly quite a few. So there will yet be more discovered like this that we don't yet know about. It's really hard to make statements about things that we don't know yet.
Right. And just one final question. I'm going to throw this to Dr. Ramslin, and we have literally 20 seconds. Are we going to see a day where you're going to be able to examine somebody at a certain age and know for a fact that that person is capable of being a serial killer?
We're going to have a probability. We're not going to know with certainty, but we will know with higher probability there will be a day for that, yes.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, ladies. Always a pleasure. Dr. Catherine Ramslin and Tracy Allman, the authors of The Serial Killer's Apprentice. It's available on Amazon. I highly recommend you get it. You are going to flip through it so very quickly. Thank you for joining us, and I hope to see you both soon.